In this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Norman Lebrecht. He is well known in Britain for his writing about music and culture and politics. He writes a column for the Evening Standard that appears on Wednesdays and on the internet has been described as required reading. He also has a BBC radio show, Lebrecht Live, and has authored many books, nonfiction books, including The Maestro Myth, Who Killed Classical Music. He has just fairly recently written and published his first novel that's titled The Song of Names, and it is now being published in the United States in paperback by Anchor Books. It won one of the big literary prizes in Britain, the Whitbread First Novel Award, and he's spending some time traveling here in the United States talking about the book, and we're pleased that he's giving us some of his time this morning. As we talk, certainly questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions or comments, you're certainly willing to pick up, or willing, invited to pick up the telephone and give us a call. Again, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Lebrecht, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. I'm sorry I can't be in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, that would be nice. It would be nice to have you here in the studio, but this is, I guess, the next best thing. Pardon me, this is sort of a pedestrian question. I'm probably, you have been asked it frequently, but I will. And that is this, after having done a lot of journalism and done a lot of nonfiction writing, what was it that pushed you to the point where you decided that you wanted to do fiction?
Well, I wasn't pushed to the point. I've been waiting to do this. I've been like a stoppered bottle for 30 years, waiting until the moment was right to write fiction. I've written 10 pretty substantial works of nonfiction. I've written an awful lot of journalism. And I used to sidle up to the travel editor and see if I could be sent to some very, very remote mountain village for a couple of weeks where I was ostensibly investigating the area for our readers, but actually practicing writing fiction. And on my last day there, I would tear it all up and come back home and start again. It's just been waiting for the moment to be right, and it just seemed right, and it all happened at once. You know, the novel was quickly bought and quickly published and quickly won a prize, and everyone seems rather happy, not least me.
And I guess we shouldn't be surprised that music figures as an important theme. Music and the musical world, the world of artists and artists' promoters, figure prominently in this story.
Well, I've, I suppose, made my reputation in writing about music, particularly about the music business, not necessarily entirely to its comfort. And it's the world I know best. But what I was really looking at in this story is the confluence between musician and non-musician. The story is about two boys growing up during the war. One is a violinistic prodigy, and the other one isn't. He's the son of an agent. But they form together a kind of a symbiosis. They're two halves of a whole. The musician can't function without the non-musician, and vice versa. And then the musician disappears on the day of his debut. What happens next? That's the story.
I certainly, you have written about not favorably about the business side of music, and I guess I'm not quite sure how you come down here on the character and the activity of the father of the one of these two boys, the one who is the impresario,
yep,
the one who decides that here this. Maybe we should at least sketch out the basic story here. We have these two boys during World War II. One of them is a violin prodigy. The other is the son of a concert promoter, someone who particularly has become well known for trying to make classical music accessible to a wider market, and also been criticized as somehow diluting its purity by a lot of people. And at any rate,
it's quite a modern theme, isn't it? We know quite a few guys like that.
So anyway, he fixes on this young man and thinks that he's a great talent and someone who can promote. The two boys become friends, and as you say, on the eve of the debut of the violinist, he disappears. And in a sense, in a very real way, this ruins the life of the one boy. And it dogs him all the way through life unto adulthood. So, and I guess I'm wondering where it is you come down here on the father, Mort Simmons, who is the man who is the concert promoter.
I think this is essentially the difference between nonfiction and fiction. In documentary writing, you have to stay true to the facts that you can prove and that you present. And sometimes you write things in sharper shades of black and white than you know to be the case, but you can't modify them, you can't mitigate them, because those are the facts that you have, and you can't prove anything beyond that. So, I've written some fairly tough stuff about the music business. I've written a book called The Maestro Myth, which argued that unless we revise our perception of what conductors are and how they work within society, we're going to reach the end of conducting as we know it, and subsequent events have rather tended to prove that. It's no coincidence that Daniel Barenboim is leaving the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. That flows from the process that I described in 1991 in The Maestro Myth. I've written a book called Who Killed Classical Music, which is about the deleterious effect of corporatization and the music business on the process of actually making music. As a result, we now have a developing crisis in classical music, which has resulted in the end of the classical recording industry, and in very, very severe conditions for much of the performing industry. Again, witness the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which has just turned in a deficit of $4 million. That's more than the budget for most orchestras. So I've approached, as it were, music very much from the journalistic, the investigative, the documentarist aspect. Here in the novel, I have a greater freedom, and I can look at a much wider picture, and I can bring to bear many of the things that I know, but that I can't write about in nonfiction, because I don't have the essential facts, or they're simply unobtainable, to show this wider picture. So I'm writing quite favorably about the music impresario, who, in other words, I have castigated, because I'm looking from the inside at his motivations. He's not entirely motivated by profit. He's motivated by the desire to share something that he knows is good, something that he knows is unique, with a much wider public, and at the same time to make a decent living out of it.
So then, is that the problem with the classical music world, that too many people are interested simply in making money?
I think we see in the United States that is at the root of the crisis. Not so much the profit motive as the monopolization and the corporatization of the business. There is one agency, I don't have to keep its name a secret, which dominates the business. Its name is Columbia Artists, or CAMI, and it controls the destinies of more than 100 conductors. Now, when you achieve that kind of concentration in any kind of business, you have what amounts to a monopoly. If Windows are now used on 92% of the world's computers, then Microsoft has the kind of monopoly in software that CAMI has in conducting. And that cannot be healthy for something as delicate and sensitive as an art. And indeed, it isn't.
This is perhaps getting away from the novel just a little bit, but I did indeed want to ask you, and you touched on it, about this prediction that you offered, and you have written about it, and it's gotten a lot of attention, that this year, in 2004, you're predicting the end of the classical music industry.
I want to make sure people
don't think I'm saying there are not going to be any more symphonies, but yes, we're talking about classical music on CD or whatever kind of recording medium you're interested in.
Well, that is in fact what we've come to. I would define industry as a process of routine production of symphonies, concertos, operas, sonatas, and the other forms of classical music. We've reached the end of that. The six major labels, the five major labels, which control something like 85% of the market, are no longer recording symphonies, operas, concertos, sonatas. They're recording crossover acts, they're recording stripping string quartets, they're recording Welsh warblers, they're recording blind tenors, but they're not continuing with the process of giving us a new generation of interpretation of the Beethoven symphonies, the Bach concertos, and so on and so forth. That has actually come to an end. There are trickles of it, there are bits of it that exist in small and medium-sized labels, but the industry, as we have known it since Edison, well, no, let's not say since Edison, since Caruso cut his first record 100 years ago, that industry comes to an end in 2004. I stand by that prediction. Hmm.
Our guest is Norman Lebrecht. He is well known in Britain and elsewhere for writing about music and culture. He's written a lot of nonfiction, including the book that he has mentioned, The Maestro Myth, Who Killed Classical Music, and he has now a new novel. It's at least new and newly available here in the United States. It's titled The Song of Names, and it is published by Anchor Books. It's available in paperback. It won the Whitbread First Novel Award, one of the big literary prizes in Britain, and he's now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And I guess, just again, to go back to touch on the news that just came out recently that Barenboim has decided he's going to leave as music director of the Chicago Symphony. Apparently, his concerns here was that he had to spend more time doing things other than music, that is, things like doing promotional activities and raising money, maybe not spending as much time on the podium or playing music as he would really like.
I think it's the way the focus has shifted and the way the priority has shifted in the musical world in the United States. Barenboim is an intensely community-oriented musician. Some of the work that he does in Berlin with the underprivileged, and particularly with a very, very deprived eastern sector of that city, is highly commendable. But what's described as community work in the United States is making nice to million-dollar donors. And after 15 years, that's not terribly interesting anymore. He wants to get back to making music. So the conditions in the United States, the conditions in a city like Chicago, are no longer conducive to maintain the loyalty of a musician like Daniel Barenboim. And what we're witnessing now, and we'll come back to the novel in a second because this is, to some extent, relates to one of its themes. What we're witnessing. Is a breakdown of loyalty, of fidelity, between musicians and society. And that is a terrible tragedy. You could not have imagined Eugene Ormandy walking out of the Philadelphia Orchestra except in a wooden box. You could not imagine Herbert von Karajan walking away from the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra except to his grave. Excuse me. Over recent years, we've seen some of the great musicians simply saying, this isn't for me anymore, I'm leaving. Hmm. Daniel Barenboim is one of them. Maris Janssens in Pittsburgh is another of them. Claudio Abbado at the Berlin Philharmonic is the third. There is a deep-seated crisis, possibly terminal, between the act of making music and the act of presenting it. In other words, the art itself and its promotion.
So now, how does that connect with the story that you tell in Song of Names?
Well, here we have these two boys growing up together, and one of them finally reaches the day of his international debut. It has been the most trumpeted, the most promoted debut there has ever been. And when it comes to the afternoon of the concert, he is nowhere to be seen. He has vanished. Why? We only find that out in the course of the novel. But one element, clearly, is the hype that has had to be manufactured in order for the public to receive a new talent. What has that actually got to do with what he does, which is taking inert notes off a page and bringing them to life? It's the beginning of that gulf between what the musician does and what the musician has to do in order to get heard. that is one of the themes of this novel.
There was a time, and really not all that long ago, where more people, at least than do today, made music for themselves. They may not have all been great musicians, but it was a popular form of entertainment that people got together and played music. And as music became increasingly available in recorded form, I think probably people tend to do that less and less. And I don't know today how many people actually do play music. What do you think we have lost in losing the ability of some number of people to pick up an instrument and play a passable music?
Oh, we've lost a tremendous amount. First of all, we've lost literacy. There was a time, our grandparents' time, yours and mine, when the hallmark of any intelligent, cultured person was that they could read music. That wasn't the case anymore in our parents' generation, and certainly not in ours. You can be cultured, but if you're faced with a page of music, you can't make head or tail of it. It's hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm. The second thing that we've lost is the ability or even the desire to play. When someone now says to you, I'm going to play you a piece of music, what they probably mean is they're going to slip a piece of plastic into the dashboard.
Yeah.
The verb to play music has changed its meaning. And so we've become no longer active participants in the process, but at the very, very best, passive recipients. And now much of what we're receiving is itself receding. And it's a terrible cultural tragedy of our generation.
Did recording do this?
No. I mean, recording like any other facet of human progress had its upside and had its downside, and part of it, yes, would have fostered that passivity, but it has also engaged far more people than ever before in the knowledge that here is music, and this is what it does, and this is what it can do directly to you. Mm-hmm. So that each of us is defined by certain pieces of music that we have heard, probably on recordings, maybe on the radio, in the way that our ancestors could never have been defined. That's a great benefit, surely. Mm-hmm. But it's that recognition, that thing that we have received, that is so important to us. I mean, the seed of discovery in the novel is where Martin, the impresario's son, mm-hmm. hears a phrase that he knows can only have been made by his friend Dovidel the prodigy.
Yeah. The book itself takes place in the present, and very slowly you're introduced to the story of who this man is, what his childhood was, the bond with the boy who was the violinist, the fact that he disappeared, and what happens at the beginning is he's roped somewhat against his will into judging a musical competition of young performers, and one of them gets up, a violinist, and does this thing, and immediately the narrator, Martin, is transported. He does this thing, as you say, he does this thing that this other violinist did, and that's how it is that he knows, certainly, that David Rappaport, who was his young friend and the violinist, must still be alive, and he must, in fact, have taught this young man this thing that he does in the performance. But I guess what really strikes me about that is the power of a musical experience to stay with a person for all of their life, and again that's something that I'm not sure how many people actually have that experience anymore.
It is an astonishing thing, the way that music imprints itself upon you in a way that no other art can. I was excuse me. When you hear a certain phrase played in a certain way, you know that only one person alive can do that. That phrase is the expression of that individual, and none of us are identical in the way that we would make that phrase. A certain piece of music, a certain sound, can fix you in time in the way that nothing else can. I was just caught on television one night by a snatch of a song, Killing Me Softly, sung by Roberta Flack, and on hearing it, this trivial pop song, on hearing it, it put me instantly in early 1973, I knew where I was, where I was living, what I was wearing, and what I was doing at 6:50 in the morning, as that song came on the radio, as I was fishing in a bachelor's sink full of unwashed crockery for a cup in which I could make a cup of tea. Music does that in the way that nothing else does. You know, we have all these fantastic security devices that greet you when you enter the United States. Some people are being fingerprinted and photographed and so forth. Actually, we should make them sing or play a couple of bars of music, and then we would know exactly who they are, because they couldn't be like anyone else. And that really is the fulcrum of the novel, the singularity that an individual can bring to music.
Yeah, and it's something that you can see with people who, maybe it's easiest to see with voices, people recognize voices. People who love opera, you play them a recording, they can tell you who it is. But also at the same token, people who love jazz, if you play Miles Davis, you'd say, well, that can't be anybody else.
Exactly.
And in the classical music world, I'm sure that if you play people a Brahms violin concerto, they'll be able to say, that's Nathan Milstein, or whoever it is, right away they'd say, well,
if you've ever heard Milstein play the Brahms, you will know immediately in his opening phrase, that is Milstein. It can't possibly be Heifetz, it can't be Isaac Stern, it can't be Ida Handel, it can't be anybody else but Milstein.
Yeah.
And that, I think, has probably never been explored before in fiction. And in fiction, you actually have the ability to relate to that, to develop it in a way that you can't do in a rather dry, documentary, musicological way, in the way that I've attempted to do in other forms of writing. And that's a great joy of fiction, because you can suddenly, by putting your finger on that, it relates to the whole of humanity.
Is that something that you think that, to the level of their ability, anyone can do, or we're talking about something that separates average players from great players?
The level that anyone can recognize, yes. Yes, you don't need a musical ear. You don't even need half of a musical ear. But if you were now to play a phrase of, let's say, Heifetz in Mendelssohn, followed by a phrase of, take a contemporary violinist, Nigel Kennedy, you would instantly know the difference. You need never have heard that particular concerto before to know that these are two very, very disparate individuals who are bringing their personalities to bear on this particular piece of music. And you won't forget it. The next time you hear a violinist playing that, you will say, no, that's somebody different. And the next time you hear Heifetz playing something completely different, or Kennedy playing Jimi Hendrix, you'll say, that's Kennedy, I know that.
Mm. We're in our midpoint here. Our guest is Norman LeBrecht. He's a British journalist and has written a lot about music and culture. He writes a regular column for the Evening Standard and has a BBC radio show, LeBrecht Live, and has written a lot about the world of classical music, and also has published now, actually a couple of years back, his first novel titled The Song of Names. It's now out here, available in the United States, published by Anchor Books. It won the Whitbread First Novel Award in 2002, and this is one of the.
It's actually awarded in 2003, so it's more recent than it sounds.
So the prize was actually given last year, 2003, it's a good book. So if you're looking for a novel, head out to the bookstore and take a look. And of course, questions are welcome here on the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Some of this, this relationship of the boy certainly is going on at the time of World War II and the Blitz in London, in Britain. You're too young to have remembered that. How is it that you managed to create such a convincing sort of a picture of what it would have been like to live through that?
Well, I was born after the war, but I was the runt of the family. My parents had had their family before the war and then stopped, and then sometime afterwards had me. So I was effectively brought up by three elder sisters, and they'd lived through the Blitz. So really, from my earliest memory, I'd had their impressions in some way or another of having endured that incredibly exciting and traumatic time. And in terms of researching it and getting it accurate and bringing out the feeling of that time, I suppose all of that was implanted in me when I was a very small child. Mm. I mean, an awful lot of people who have lived through that time told me that they felt that I'd done it authentically, and obviously I'm very pleased and very proud to have done that.
Sure. Well, that's I have no idea now how many people living in Britain were born since then who would not have remembered, but is still today in 2004, do you think British life is still marked by the experience of World War II?
Yes, more so than the United States. Yes, it was a defining moment in nationhood, because the nation itself was under such threat from the Nazis, and we were, as it were, the last bastion, the last domino that didn't fall against Hitler's thrust. So there is still very much a focus on it and an obsession. But the novel is very much about memory and the way that music relates to memory and conveys memory. We know that scientifically that music is the most retentive form of the brain. One of the stories in the novel is a Holocaust story, how a Hasidic rabbi in the concentration camps sought to memorialize all of the people who died by including their names in a tune, a hymn, a song of names that was sung every evening, growing longer and longer and longer the more that people died, with the evening prayers. They couldn't write down these names. They would have been taken from them and destroyed. The only way that the memory of the dead could be retained in any kind of accuracy and integrity was musically.
And that is a fiction. That's something that you have invented.
That is a fiction that I've invented, although a number of reviewers have referred to it as fact. Yeah. That is a fiction that I've invented. But it is based on a knowledge of the way the Hasidic masters wrote their music and the way that that music was transmitted. I met a man who was born in Warsaw. This is after I'd finished the novel and submitted it, and it was in proof. I met a man who, at 9 years old, would get sent by his community from Warsaw, 300 kilometers, to where their Rebbe, their spiritual leader, lived, because he had a good musical ear. He couldn't read music, but he was sent there to learn all the new tunes and bring them back to the community. And I said, "Well, how did you do that?" And he said, "Well, it was." You know, there would be a theme, a tune, and there would be another tune, and then there would be it would change a bit. I said, "You mean variation?" He said, "Yes." And then there would be a variation on the second one, and then there would be a cross variation. And what he was singing to me and explaining to me was a process that was really differed very little from what Bach did in the Goldberg variations. And so the ability to use music to convey devotion and faith, and in this case memorialization, has always been there, and I've simply extended it, or it simply came to me as part of this story, that this should be the Song of Names.
As we have sketched out the story, and I, you know, whenever I talk with someone who's written a novel, I try to have people listening get some of the idea of what the book is about, and I also try not to give too much away. I wouldn't want someone to come away from the program saying, "Well, and now I know what it's all about, and there's no point in reading the book." That really is not going to do anything for the author, certainly. But you know, as we have talked,
maybe they want to write their own Song of Names. This is the only the only place they can find out how to do it.
Well, maybe then that would happen, and we would inspire to people to go out and write their own novels, listening to. And I think that is, you know, in past conversations with writers, I have here and there tried to ask questions about writing, because I think that that's also interesting as well, and some of the tricks that maybe people have employed. I have someone who's done a lot of writing, but is first novelist. I guess did you find moving into fiction just a sort of a natural kind of thing? Were there any difficulties or problems for you as you
I've been longing to do it for so long. It's been the fulfillment of such desire and such ambition that it felt like a tremendous liberation. I've loved it. I've loved every minute of it. I'm continuing to do it. I've just finished my second novel. It's wonderful, and it also feels just a little bit illicit, forbidden, at my age, in my mid-50s, to be doing this, to be starting over, to be doing something new. When I won the Whitbread, one of the British newspapers described me as, I think, a bearded old novelist in a baggy sweater, suggesting that somebody who was in his 50s shouldn't be allowed to win a first novel prize. This should be, for clearly intended for people who are just starting out in life. So it feels like I'm bucking a trend here, and that feels good.
Yes, this was The Guardian that writes, according to the law of precedent, Norman LeBrecq should be sexy. He should, through a mixture of makeup and attitude, arrest the attention of newspaper editors. He should be young, too, of course, and lethally fashionable. That he is none of these things by a long stretch has ensured that the five writers who have today won Whitbread Awards, yada, yada, yada. I think that's the one you...
That's right.
That's the one you're referring to. And so you didn't find that at all annoying or troubling?
No, I found it absolutely delightful. It's wonderful to be... in a sense, it's a vindication of what I've done, yes, because I have waited. I have... I suppose, in the olden times, one would tell one's daughters to wait. And I have waited. I have waited until I felt I was ready. And it's been a very much a bottled-up process. I've longed to write these novels. I have these stories that are backing up like planes waiting for takeoff at Chicago airport. And I've just waited until I felt I was ready. Mm-hmm. I can do this. It needs to be done before I finally started writing novels.
Well, in the very last paragraph, this does include a little story here that you apparently tell about Wilhelm Furtwängler, who was a conductor who conducted the Berlin Philharmonic. And apparently players in the orchestra were always asked how they knew when it was time to come in. Some of them relied on a nod of the head or some of the conductor's other tics. But you quote from you as the one thing that really struck me, the thing I remembered was the musician who said, I waited until I could wait no longer, and then I came in. And you seemed there to be, in a sense, talking about yourself.
That's right. That's right. Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. It's just one of these things that I've kept sort of very close within me until I could no longer keep it. And... for it to work, first of all, for somebody to like it enough to want to take it on and publish it, and for then reviewers to like it, and then juries and prizes to be awarded, and to appear in the United States, and for us to be talking about movie rights. This is beyond the stuff of dreams.
Mm. So you think this might end up being made into a film?
Well, we're just in the process of negotiating film rights. Yeah,
That's the kind of thing that I can imagine could lead to great disappointment on the part of a writer, depending on what it is that people decided to do with it. Because often it ends up, some writers are fortunate enough to be able to write screenplays or have some input, and others just they give up the name, and
yep.
They might look at the film and say, "Well, they used the title of my book and the names of the characters, but it didn't go." Much further than that.
Well, the most important thing for me is to preserve the integrity of the two characters, the narrator and the missing violinist, and so I've been given scriptwriter approval in the contract.
As we've told the story, that this does involve the two boys and the one boy who was the prodigy who was built up to the point where he couldn't take it and disappears on the eve of his debut. And many years later, the son, Martin, manages to find him again and talk, and at least he gets some understanding about what happened. And I think you get the impression, certainly, that as far as Dave was concerned, the violinist, that for him, his ability constitutes something of a burden because he seems to feel that maybe he's not as great as everybody thinks that he is. And I wonder if that's something that you have seen a lot, or do you think that it's common that performers, either you have performers who perhaps are very good and think that they are very good, or on the other hand, you have those that are very good and have some doubts, and maybe they indeed do think, well, people out there think that I'm the greatest thing that's ever come along, and I know that that's really not true. And for I think for David Rappaport, that's a burden that he just decides that he just can't carry.
David, that is such an important point. That is such an important point, and exists in the lives of so many great artists. How you separate yourself from the gift, whether you actually resent the gift, whether you wish that you hadn't had it, that you could have been, you could have been running a cigar store or been an accountant or been something else, had a normal life, because the life is not normal that great performers live. The almost schizoid relation that great artists have to their own genius, that is very much at the heart of the story. And I remember something an old English poet once told me. His name is Ronald Duncan, and he wrote the libretto of Britten's second opera, The Rape of Lucretia. And he said in 1947 he'd gone up to his room in the hotel in Edinburgh where they were there for the festival, and he found Benjamin Britten walking pigeon-toed down the corridor along the carpet. And he said, "Ben, what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm trying to avoid the lines in the carpet. If I can get to the end of this carpet without touching any of the lines, then maybe I'll know I'm a good composer." So there's that always in the great ones. There's that element of doubt and the element of resentment about the gift, the burden that they have to bear. And how one copes with it, and those who do it successfully, I think probably come within a hair's breadth of what my protagonist did, which is duck out, disappear.
Mm-hmm. That story about Britten is such a sad story in a way, when you think about someone of that level of ability to also have that level of doubt. But again, maybe as you say, that's just in so many people, that's simply going to go hand in hand.
Well, you're thinking of somebody who's 2 years before had written the most successful opera of modern times, Peter Grimes, which within 18 months of its premiere had been shown in 8 other countries and wound up both at the Met and at La Scala. And he's still smitten by the doubt of whether he can do it. It is an astonishing thing, and I think everyone who honestly engages in art gets up in the morning and asks himself or herself why. Firstly, why me? Why have I been given this? And can I do this? Can I carry on with it? Am I big enough for it?
We have about 15 minutes left. We're talking with Norman Lebrecht, very well-known commentator on music and culture and politics. He writes a regular column for the Evening Standard newspaper, a British newspaper, has a show on BBC, Lebrecht Live, and has written a lot about classical music, and has a novel that last year received the Whitbread First Novel Award. That's one of Britain's big literary prizes. The novel is titled The Song of Names, and it's now out in paperback. It's available now in the United States, published by Anchor Books. So you might go out to the bookstore and look at it. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455.
I'm told you won't have any trouble finding it in the bookstore because Barnes & Noble has selected it as part of their Discover program.
Ah, very good, very good. Perhaps we talk a little bit more about, we've talked some about the character of David Rappaport, who was the violinist, and what happened to him. Here, the other character, Martin Simmons, who was the son of the impresario, Mort Simmons, who was the boyhood friend of the violinist. His life was really shaped by, in a sense, one event. I don't know how often that happens in real life, but it happens a lot in fiction. The course of his life was really shifted dramatically by one event, and that is the disappearance of David. It wrecked his life. It wrecked his family. And it's something that, he seems to have carried with him all that time. And it's more than just perhaps his wanting to know what happened. Why do you think that that this character's life was so, in a sense, scarred by this betrayal? Or is it that you think that that's how he sees it? He did see it as a betrayal.
Well, firstly, this is something that happens to a lot of us, whether we acknowledge it or not. There are defining moments in our lives, maybe an early bereavement. It may be the moment of falling in love or being rejected in love. That there are moments which actually change the course of our lives or fix them permanently at one particular spot, and this is what happens to Martin. It happens particularly with people who are involved with artists, because the artist possesses something of the extraordinary that imprints itself on those who are, to most intents and purposes, merely ordinary. And they can so take over their lives that when they remove their grace, when their favor is turned elsewhere, or when they, in the case of Dovital in this novel, disappear, what results is an amputation, almost a severance of part of Martin's personality. Part of that personality just disappeared, vanished, when Dovital walked away. So he lives literally a half-life, because the better half of him, the most important part of him, is there no longer. And I've seen that quite often in relationships between artists and other people, the way that artists take over and then betray the people who are close to them. And I've seen people who have walked around in a kind of skeletal shell in the way that Martin does. So something of Martin's personality emerges, not consciously, but unconsciously, from observation of those who have been deeply scarred, devastated by their engagement with great artists.
That it gets at something that I suppose some people might argue was a cliche about artists, that they are so focused on what it is they do that often it makes it impossible for them, in a normal sort of way, to manage human relationships. Do you think that that is indeed beyond a cliche, and in fact is perhaps more true than it is an image that we have about artists?
There is an egotism about artists that is quintessential to what they do, yes. If an artist didn't believe that he or she could do that better than anybody else, there would be no point in doing it at all. And that egotism, that self-absorption, makes normal relationships very difficult. They can be sustained, but usually only as a result of sacrifice on the part of the other person in the relationship. A self-sacrifice, yes, even self-immolation.
So does having some closure on this, do you think, help? I realize we're talking about fictional characters. But does having some closure on this help Martin?
Martin is completely reborn. I mean, when the evidence of his ears finally leaves him to discover Dovital in another setting, yes, this is regenerative for him, because he's able to confront the betrayal. He's able to confront the defector. He's able to begin to understand what it is that has happened to his life and start, even at this late stage, 40 years later, to rebuild it and to renew himself. It's vindicative. It's restorative. It's a rebirth. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And he starts having a tremendous amount of fun. All the fun that he should have been having in the past 40 years suddenly has to be condensed into this time of rediscovery.
I suppose it does get at this idea that we become so attached to artists, various kinds of artists, and depend on what they do for various kinds of satisfaction, that if then we should develop that kind of dependence, and they should say, well, I'm not going to do this anymore. that would make us angry, that we would feel that we were being denied something that had become very important to us, and that this person was being selfish. They were only thinking of themselves, and they say, no, you can't do that. You've got to keep on doing what you do for me.
Well, that's right. I don't want to get all Freudian about this. The artist, in this respect, represents the mother. The artist freely gives and then suddenly withdraws, which leaves us in a state of pretty advanced neurosis. How do we handle this for the rest of our lives?
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious here, going back to talking about what's happening in the world of music, the contemporary world of music, and how perhaps performers and the music is being crushed under the weight of the business side of things. And your comments about what's happening with recorded classical music. Some people have, they're trying to figure out what now alternative means of distribution means for all kinds of music, certainly
sure.
for popular music, and what it means that apparently in the future, we will no longer go down to some kind of brick-and-mortar music store like we all used to and flip through the bins looking at records and whatever kind of record it is that you find exciting, that's over.
That future is very nearly upon us.
Yeah. And at the same time, some people argue that the advantage is that now for performers that aren't going to be picked up by large companies and big distributors, it is actually possible for more and more for people to make and distribute their own music and to somehow use the internet, if not to distribute it, at least to promote it and sell it. So I guess that some people argue that that would be a good thing for an awful lot of performers, people who are really interested in making music but might not appeal to an enormous commercial audience, and certainly that's affecting pop music. Does that have any kind of impact, do you think, on the classical music world?
Absolutely, yes. And we socially we're living through the biggest revolution in 250 years. The means of communication are changing. The means of manufacture are changing. The means by which we individualize the products around us and the world around us have been completely transformed over the past decade. So clearly, music must change in exactly the same way. How we are able to transmit and to share music in future, when it can no longer be concretized onto a disc, when it can no longer be shared, when you and I can no longer discuss something, an object that we both have in our houses. Let's say we both have Klemperer's recording of Bruckner's Fourth Symphony. We can discuss that as between us as an object. But when it comes to a time where you want to discuss Antonio Papano's performance of that with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and I want to discuss his performance with that in the London Symphony Orchestra, and neither of us were present at the same performance, how are we going to have the means to do that? That is only just beginning to evolve, and clearly the Internet plays an enormous part in it. The universality of the things that we're doing has suddenly become real. I have no doubt that if somebody in England or in Germany or in Hong Kong wants to listen to this conversation on the Internet, they probably can do. My own show on BBC Radio 3 gets this huge international audience, and the people of BBC are flummoxed by this, and they say, "Ooh, people are ringing in from distant parts, and they're not part of the BBC's natural audience, and they don't know how to handle this, or they're emailing in from around the world." As I'm sure they will do, or they are doing already, to your show, David. This is the beginning of a new era of mass communications. We don't know how it's all going to pan out. All that we do know is that the old forms are stultifying, and we must find a way of transmitting the essence of those into the new forms without destroying it.
Yeah. Well, I think we're probably at about the point where we need to say goodbye. I just want to say thank you very much, Mr. Lebrecht, for talking with us. We'd certainly appreciate it.
Well, David, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. I mean, I do hope I'll have a swing by Champagne Urbana at some time on a book signing tour, and if I do, I'll drop into your studio in person. But at the moment, the nearest I can get is New York, and it's been really very enjoyable talking to you and to your
listeners. Well, indeed, we would be happy to have you. And again, our guest, Norman Lebrecht, if you would like to read his novel, it's titled The Song of Names, won the Whitbread First Novel Award when it was published in Britain, is now available in the United States. It's published in paper by Anchor Books. His column appears in the Evening Standard newspaper once a week and also does that show on BBC Radio, Lebrecht Live. And all of that is, I'm sure, available on the internet for people who would like to experience it. Again, I thank you very much. We appreciate
David,
it.
Thank you.